This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing.
The title of the book, Despite Fear, A Visceral Plight. And the author is Zenko Case, and Zenko joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, and this interview is brought to you by Lulu Publishing. Hello, Zenko.
Hello.
Great to have you with us. Now, your book, Despite Fear, is really your story, and you've had a lot of challenges, and you say, you found your way through these challenges, not as a victim, which a lot of people feel they are, but as an intact soul. So we're going to talk about how you've journeyed through all these challenges. And of course, you want to inspire people to recover and resolve, because everybody goes through pain, right?
Right, exactly. That's life.
That is life. And you have had plenty of pain.
Well, it's sort of built into a volcano, yes.
You know,
apparently.
Even to the point where you almost were shot to death.
Yes, yes. I was at death's door, you might say, at the edge of life.
Right. So as you look back, and this book is more of your memoirs, right? It's taken from your journal.
Yes, yes. Journal, and I filled in some backstory, and so it's pretty much my inside story.
Your inside story, and it starts out when you're about how old? What, 18?
Well, I go back to 6 or 7 years old. But
okay.
I first got married 2 weeks after my 18th birthday.
2 weeks after your 18th birthday, a lot of folks at that age maybe don't quite know what they're doing.
No, they just want to get out and on with their whatever their life is going to be.
Right.
So they don't have a clue.
So
nor did I.
Yeah. Well, we don't want to focus a whole lot on all the pain. We really want to help people understand how to get through the pain, but we need to kind of set the record straight. So how many marriages did you have?
I was married 4 times.
And how many children?
Took 3 to get to the pot of gold.
Okay, so it took 3 to get to
the good one.
And how many children do you have?
I have 4 children.
4 children, and with mm-hmm. and those were with how many different husbands?
With 3 different men.
Okay. Okay, so are those men still around? Or, I mean, are they in touch with you or your daughters or anything?
No.
Okay, is that good?
They're either deceased or not in touch.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, two of my daughters' fathers have deceased, and the third one is not in touch.
Well, we all know that life has ups and downs. We sometimes wonder if we're ever going to get back up, because it feels like we're in a pit, right?
Oh, it's a deep, dark abyss sometimes where there's no light anywhere.
Right.
And you can't imagine how to get out of it, because there's no light and consequently no direction. So you really have to just start pushing, even though you don't know what direction to push in, or, you know, you can't see. You just have to push.
When you say push, what do you mean by push? Push against the pain, or push against the problems?
No, you don't push against the problem. You sit with the problem, and you push your way out. You push your way toward... Since I came from the light, I was blown into an abyss from a place of light. I knew it existed somewhere, even if I could not see it anywhere right then and there.
Mm-hmm.
So I just kept pushing up. And I had, like I say, no direction of which way that was.
And you've already talked about the love of your life, but as you said, how could you have known it would have a tragic ending? Tell us about that. Tell us about what happened.
We had been married for quite a few years, coming up up on our 10th anniversary. And when we met, we were in our 40s. He just was about to turn 40. I was 44. I was divorced with four young girls. He had never had any children. So that's reflective of the man he was, taking on a woman with four girls. But when I mentioned that, he got rather indignant, and so I said, "Okay, I'll never say you don't know what you're getting into again." Because four girls are quite a circus at time. We became he was a great supporting father to them. He didn't expect to be called dad or anything like that. He was a best friend to all of us. My youngest daughter was dating this young man who had so-called millionaire father and had been raised apparently with entitlements in replacement of human values, I suspect. They dated for about a year. She met him at her work. She was in school, and one of her college friends introduced them. Well, at school, yeah, she was working as well. They broke up. Actually, he broke up with her. He became a little abusive, obsessive, possessive, and they broke up. He wanted to get back together and became extremely obsessive, started stalking the house after she got a restraining order on him, after some physical stuff happened. He called the house like 200 times one weekend. The records were pulled later. I didn't really realize that it was that much, but it was. Anyway, she told him no, and apparently he had never been told no because he snapped into sociopath mode and shot his way into our house with a .45 Magnum and carried a knife and bag full of reloaded bullets. And it was 5 o'clock on a Sunday morning. We were sound asleep. It was dark outside. I went out on the deck. He shot through the French door, through my chest, and proceeded to unload the gun around me, stepped in, looked right at me, and I sort of screeched, "What are you doing?" You know, because we knew the kid, and we didn't really have a volatile relationship with him, had premonitions about, had, you know, reserves about him, but tried to be gracious parents and dissuade our daughter from hanging out with him. We didn't prohibit it, but we said, you know, you're not a 37-year-old married woman with 7 kids. You don't need this kind of stress. And so anyway, my husband was in the living room. We passed in the bedroom. He went toward him. I went toward the phone. I turned my back on him and walk away toward the phone. Called 911, heard another gunshot. I was in a full panic at that time. I could hear them rustling on the deck. All of a sudden, the phone went dead. The dispatcher was asking me where I got shot because there was so much blood coming out. I was standing in a pool, and I couldn't figure out where it was coming from because it was such a mess. He came up behind me and shot me vertically up through the back of the head. The phenomenal thing is I didn't lose consciousness at that point. I slumped onto the ground. I heard the heavy boots of the sheriffs come in the entryway, and they said, "Is anybody here?" And I weakly said, "I'm up here." And I remember the EMTs coming in with a gurney, says, "Can you get on the gurney?" And I said, "My adrenaline is so high that I could raise the roof right now." And I stood up and got on the gurney. And the story goes on from there into through the hospital, right. Brain surgeries. I actually named him in the hallway of the hospital because one of the first investigators got in his car and drove as fast as he could an hour to the hospital because I was in the care flight. And when he asked me if I knew who if somebody was at my house last night, I finally felt safe enough to say his name, because I didn't feel safe on the phone. I was afraid he would hear me and finish me off.
So how do you, that's an incredible, I mean, that's out of the movies, you know, we're out of the
TV.
We never think that could possibly happen.
It's real that, yeah. You know, that's somewhere else, some other country
right,
or some other
right,
family.
Exactly. So when you look back on all of that, obviously all the physical pain, all the emotional trauma, all the many words that we can't even come up with to describe what you were going through, how do you come out of that and move on with your life?
By staying in the now, by staying in the moment. Because despite PTSD, meltdowns, and extreme emotional trauma, I was okay right here and right now. The past was terrorizing. The immediate past was full of terror. And the future was unknown. I mean, I lost my everything in a heartbeat. I lost the love of my life. I lost us. I lost me. I came out of it paralyzed and half blind, and so the future was unknown, pretty dark. I had no idea how I was going to function by myself going forward. So I had to relearn everything, relearn how to feed myself, tie my shoes, you know, everything. But back to your question.
Yeah. How did you find the light again?
I don't know how to describe that, other than I just kept pushing to get better, to pushing to get on my feet again, pushing to stand up. And one day, maybe 5 to 7 years after the incident, I woke up one day and I knew in my gut that I was out of the abyss. I knew I had hit the rim. I knew I was standing outside of the darkness. I knew I had made it out of the place that I got blown into. And it was, gratitude. Oh my God. You know, it was the most, the hardest thing one could ever do. Is get through that, you know, and it's getting through it is what the recovery is. You can't get stuck in it. You can't give up. Persevere and just have the faith that one of these days you'll get through it. You'll be out of it.
In just the time we have left, you write, "I found solace and strength in faith." Just give us some feelings as we conclude our discussion about Despite Fear, the title of your book.
Mm-hmm. Faith is not the same as beliefs. Beliefs are not always true. But having faith is abandoning your little self, your ego, your mental makeup, to something bigger, higher, and with more light and beyond yourself.
Looking to a power that is much beyond you.
Beyond you, yes. Loving something. And that was the incredible thing about my last marriage to the love of my life. I mean, it's true love when you love something more than yourself. And that was indicative of having faith, you know, in something bigger than yourself. And you have to really put your ego and your mental makeup on the back burner, to not let it control or have the power. It doesn't get the power. You have to take the power away from it and give it to something higher and bigger. True power.
True power, true change.
True power. Not having anything to do with money.
Yeah. True change, true awareness, to see a whole new way of thinking and living.
Right. Right.
Well, you're proof of it, Zenko, and that's what makes your book so inspiring. And for everyone, again, Despite Fear, A Visceral Plight, and we've been talking to Zenko Case. She is the author, and of course, this is her journal, her memoirs, and incredible experience, and has found herself and lives in happiness and peace at this time in her life. Zenko, what's the best way to get your book?
You can go through Lulu. I have a website, and Lulu is the editor, is the Lulu Press.
And what is your website?
It's Authors for, I think it's Lulu, Despite Fear.
Okay, yeah. All right.
I don't have it memorized yet.
No problem. I can edit this part out, so no problem.
Yeah, any way you search for it, it'll take you to Lulu.
Well, and of course, of all the retail outlets, online retail outlets for books.
And Amazon and IndieBooks, all those too, yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Zenko. We've really appreciated the time with you, and are so thankful that you're where you are today in your life and finding peace. And we thank you for being with us on Indie Book Publishing.
Thank you so much.
And this interview has been brought to everyone by Lulu Publishing.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Have you heard? The pages of American Patchwork and Quilting magazine come to life on our new weekly online radio show, American Patchwork and Quilting. Join Pat Sloan, our blogging and quilt designer host, as she talks about the latest trends, ideas, and inspirations. Her guests include quilt pattern designers, authors, quilt shop owners, and our editors. All quilters, just like you, call in with your questions. Get quilting tips from industry experts. Learn about free patterns. Hear behind-the-scenes stories from our magazines, American Patchwork and Quilting, Quilt Sampler, and Quilts and More. Get the scoop on free stuff. And find out more about the best independent quilt shops in North America. To listen to a live show, tune in Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern. Just log on to allpeoplequilt.com/radio. To hear past shows, go to iTunes and search for American Patchwork and Quilting Radio. We hope you'll join us because we know that quilting changes everything.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Seven Rights for Citizen Slackers. With notes from the battles of Good King Boaz and the author, Dennis Boaz. He joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, and this interview is brought to you by Lulu Publishing. Hello, Dennis.
Oh, hi, Steve.
Great to just great to have you with us. We're going to have a lively discussion about human rights, citizen rights. You've got your very unique take on it, especially given all the following this very highly contested election and the presidential election, and you really, as you put it, you reread the Declaration of Independence, and what jumped out at you?
Well, what jumped out at me was that it was the intent of our revolutionaries to have a government whose purpose was to secure the rights of people. In fact, that's what they believed governments were. They, in the Declaration, in the second paragraph, which is where all the heavy stuff is found, it says governments are initiated to secure the rights of the people. Some other words in there, and it says, and when those rights, when a government is destructive of those rights, it's the right of the people to alter or abolish the form of government, which in this case is the Constitution. And frankly, I no need to abolish the Constitution. We can amend it into any form we want to, given enough time. As long as it, to me, eventually gets back to the point that government is established to secure the people's rights. And that didn't happen in the Constitution, 11 years after the Declaration, you can look at the preamble and you can see the rights there are national rights, and the individual rights are thrown at the back of the bus. So my premise is that we got started off in the wrong foot with the Constitution, which is a document which organizes the powers of government. That's the purpose of it. Human rights are thrown in at the end, and there are only some of those. There's some social rights, but where are the educational, cultural, safety rights? They're not there. So we didn't start our government based on human rights, and I think if we had, or if we do some point in the future, then we'll be able to achieve the purpose of government, which is to secure the rights of the people, and that's all the rights of the people. I mean, if you just secured some of the rights of the people, you'd have an imbalanced government, and that's what we have now. We just secure some of the rights of people, and so we're just limping along as a government and as a society, because those a full body of rights was never taught to us, and I believe that I discovered and developed a full, complete body of balanced and comprehensive rights that'll make the lives of people in our country and potentially everywhere better.
So do you
more remarkable?
So do you see the Democrat Party or the Republican Party really representing the people today, their rights or their desires?
No, I don't. You know, it's they're into one of the rights, and that's the rights of the people to have power. As I see it, that's one of the seven rights, and we manifest that through democracy. We don't have a representative democracy. You know, I won't insist on a pure democracy, too many people, but we don't have a meaningful representative democracy. Because we have private money and public elections, and we have an electoral college which prevents each person from having one vote. And the Electoral College, of course, is anti-democratic. We don't even have the right to democracy in the Constitution. You know, it's found in the Declaration of Independence. Eight rights are found in the Declaration of Independence, and none of those are found in the Constitution. Isn't that kind of strange? I guess they decided they couldn't really achieve the rights of the people, so why put them in the Constitution?
So your title says Seven Rights for Citizen Slackers. Now, tell us about your term citizen slackers. Who are they?
Well, they're all of us, actually. They are the citizens. I mean, if government was established to secure the rights of people, why did we only have one person, Madison, who tried to tell us what our rights were? And if you look at those rights, they're mostly defenses against abuses of the British colonial government. So they're social rights in terms of how we punish people, right, and what our rights are when we're punished by a government. But there were no cultural rights. There are no educational rights. There aren't even any safety rights in there. And yet you'll find that in the Declaration of Independence, those rights. So one of my premises is we need to include all the rights of the Declaration of Independence because for some reason they were ignored. And the Ninth Amendment protects those rights because it says nothing in the enumeration of rights in the Constitution shall not be construed to demean or disparage others retained by the people. And in 1787, what rights did the people have? None other than the rights of the Declaration of Independence. And we have the right to change government according to our revolutionary founders, but when it takes two-thirds of the legislatures of the United States and then three-fourths of them are political conventions to ratify any amendments from a constitutional convention, that's hardly a right, at least in the Constitution. And yet, that's what we have to go through to amend the Constitution, because Congress is not going to amend the Constitution in any serious way. And we have several problems in the Constitution which prevent us from having a meaningful representative democracy. And so one amendment at a time won't do it. We need an Article 5 convention. And that's where the citizen slackers, that's us. Whereas if more of us get involved, we can change this and establish our government so that it's more balanced and so that the resources of government are apportioned more evenly across the board.
Well, that is the genius of our government, of citizen involvement. That is so critical, and most of us, you know, we vote, and like you point out, we pay taxes, and, you know, we, of course, you know, in times of war, we go to war, and but you're saying
it's more... But we're never fully informed. You know, that's one of the five rights. I call it the right to truth. Some people would call it the right to know. It doesn't much matter. It's also the right to justice and fairness. But unless we're informed as to what's going on, we can't do our job. And you know, I didn't put it in my book, but frankly, one of the, I could have added, I finished the book, The Substance of It, November of 2014, and it wasn't crucial to me to, you know, to finish it just as the prior day's news events ended, because it, its premises are beyond the daily news.
So as you look at the presidential candidates that were vying to become president in this last campaign, Bernie and Hillary and Mr. Donald, any of them represent citizens?
Well, they all represent some citizens, right? I mean, Hillary won the popular election, and Donald won the election where it really counted. Again, you know, I've been harping on against the Electoral College since the 90s when I initiated a petition in Guam, which I call Guahan in deference to the Guamanians or Guahanians. They changed the name of their island territory, but, you know, it takes a while for the cartographers to catch up. And pretty expensive, I imagine, to change all the maps in the world for one little teeny tiny territory. But at least start that petition so they could vote in federal elections and vote for president. You know, they can't, they're supposedly they're Americans, but they can't vote for president, and they send their daughters and sons off to be killed in our various conflicts, and it's unfair. And at the same time, so that the votes of Wahinians would matter, I also had that, and that petition was to abolish the Electoral College so they could have a vote that was meaningful. And frankly, look at California, where I, as a Californian, voted, and the votes didn't matter, you know. I mean, we didn't get the candidates coming out here except for money and to speak with their friends who had money, but we Californians were kind of ignored in the election. But in terms of people, in terms of demographics, Bernie touched the millennials more than any other candidate. And he's very progressive, and except for his protectionism. I don't agree with the protectionism element that came into it, because that seems to fly in the face of the innovation we do in this country, which, and it says that we need to keep our jobs as they are. Well, technology is changing things too fast. If Bernie had said, we're all entitled to a lifetime continuing education so we can keep up with technology, then I think that would have been a more improved argument rather than just a right to education at public universities. I mean, most of the important education is going to be done on the internet, and there, of course, after the internet studies and the collaboration among groups of people. But it doesn't have to be all brick and mortar education to get a good education anymore. And that's what people should have. I mean, if the people in the Rust Belt are willing to move, and if they had a right to a lifetime education, they could move anywhere where jobs were needed. And if we had an educational system that taught about our whole self, the mental, physical, emotional, and the creative, we would learn about our full potentials. And that's the problem with the teaching on human rights in this country, is they're not taught as human potentials, but they're taught as how to defend ourselves against the abuses of government. And that's about all students know about human rights. we realize, we recognize our potential, our human potentials and our full range of human desires, then they would realize how shameful it is that we haven't gotten a full education so that we could achieve our full potentials. We are educated mostly left brain or mental and physical and in school, and we ignore our emotional or psychological and our creative selves. So we get a half-brain education. So what I have here, these seven rights for seven citizens, not only applies to government, but it could be applied, and to change government would take much longer because we have to go through an Article 5 convention. But we could be changing education now and through our charter schools and eventually to our general public schools if it were to ever catch hold. And we could change the corporate structure of our businesses by basing salaries along seven levels of consciousness or rights. I have a corporate system that reduces the difference, the wage inequality difference, and does a lot of other things for the workers that the current corporations don't do. I mean, if you base your corporations on attaining the rights of the workers and the instead of the profits of the shareholders, you really have a different outlook on business. And I believe this kind of business could outcompete typical corporations, because I think the typical corporations are too top-heavy in terms of salary to upper management.
Your education goes all the way back to the Berkeley New Age sojourn, as you put it, and back in the 70s. So a foundation was built there, as you put it,
yeah,
a rate, as you called them, ancient raw origins of a comprehensive body of rights.
Right. Well, okay. Let's start with the chakras of the Upanishads. The chakras, seven chakras, represent. I studied for a couple of years with a writer and a Hindu tantric and a philosopher, and he taught the chakras as levels of consciousness and levels of desire. And at the end, because he says that he used to say, he's deceased now, he would say that everything we're conscious of, we want to have, touch, feel, love, control. In other words, we want it. We're curious about it. We want to eat outer space. We want to know about it. We want to do it. Everything that's there, we want to know something about in our reality. And so that's what the chakras were, or at least in the way they're modernly interpreted, is that they're levels of consciousness, and they include everything. But they're linear. I studied the Egyptian tarot, and I studied with a social anthropologist. I took 6 months of detailed instruction on the symbols of the Egyptian tarot. And that's where I learned that there are four, that we are, the way the Egyptians defined us, and I agree with it, humans are fourfold. We're mental, physical, emotional, intuitive, or intuitive slash creative beings. And once you establish this, it's like these four elements are the playing field of life. We do things mentally, physically, emotionally, creatively. Then you have the foundation of the four, and on top of that, you have the seven chakras, which say that mentally we have seven levels of consciousness. Physically, we have the same seven levels of consciousness. Emotionally, same seven levels. So those can be transferred into human rights, because human rights are fundamental desires. So you see there is this connection between the Hindu chakras and levels of desire or levels of human rights. And so I just, in a sense, transliterated chakras and gave them English names that we can understand as rights. And it's really a four-sided, seven-leveled organizational system that ultimately, and I have graphics in the book, that can be understood by a citizen. And once it's understood what potentials are being denied by our educational system, I think we may have a movement towards a holistic educational system instead of the half-assed educational system we now have. And I say that as a credentialed teacher, having taught for 8 years high school, as well as having been a lawyer for more than 30 years. That's where my knowledge of basic human rights and my ability to read legal documents comes from.
Well, Dennis, we appreciate you sharing about your book, Seven Rights for Citizen Slackers. Dennis Boaz is the author, and of course the publisher is Lulu. Tell us the best way to get your book, Dennis.
Amazon, Lulu, Barnes & Noble, it's ebook, and I've made it very affordable. I believe I have a blueprint for societal transformation that can be very enduring. I've made it affordable on ebook. It's an affordable private. It's
right
down at the bottom for ebooks. I don't know whether I should say the price or not, but if you can't afford a paperback, then you can afford an ebook. And I think it's important to read. It will help change the perspective of citizens and get them more involved. And I frankly want all citizen slackers to become citizen partners, because I believe the social contract is no longer just between citizens and their government. I believe it's among citizens, among each other, and that we have a right and duty to secure and encourage these rights for one another. That's my philosophy.
Well, thank you, Dennis, for being with us.
You bet.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing. And we'll be right back after these messages.
It's the Fitness Minute with fitness expert Annette Hammond.
When your focus is to lose weight or maintain your present weight, exercising effectively to burn the most calories is crucial. You want to give yourself every advantage to burn as many calories as possible. One good tip is to do your strength training exercises standing up so you can keep your heart rate up. Another tip is to perform multi-joint exercises when you can. For example, as you're doing a forward lunge, add bicep curls while you're coming up from the lunge. Another example is to execute a wide squat, and as you're coming up from the squat, perform a shoulder press. By doing these multi-joint exercises, you're putting more demands on your body, keeping your heart rate up, and working more muscles at the same time. The goal is to burn the most calories during that workout. I'm Annette Hammond. To hear other fitness and weight loss tips, visit our website at AnnetteHammond.com.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Left Shift, How and Why America is Heading to Second-Rate Single-Payer Healthcare. And the author is Dr. David Armstrong. And Dr. Armstrong joins us now on Indie Book Publishing. And this interview is brought to you by Archway Publishing. Hello, Doctor.
Good afternoon.
Great to have you with us. When we think about health care, of course, Obamacare, that's been in the news so much for so long, and now with a new administration talking about replacing it and all that. But we hear health care today, and we often hear the words, as you point out in your book, universal coverage, nationalized health care, socialized medicine. It sounds so good, free medicine, free medical care. But you've worked in both worlds, in Britain and now here in the United States. In Britain, how long have they had national health care?
So it was introduced in Britain in the 1940s after World War II. And prior to that, it was a diverse mix of private health care, voluntary organizations, some public health care. But post-World War II, as a political necessity, it was radically changed by a left-wing Labour government where the whole system was scrapped and a single-payer system was introduced.
And you worked in that for how long?
Almost 10 years.
So almost 10 years there, and now you practice here in the United States. So you've had, obviously, a very clear, practical, experienced understanding of both systems.
Indeed. I've had a front seat to how both systems work, to the positive aspects of both systems, to the negative aspects of both systems. And so I think I bring a unique perspective to the whole debate on healthcare delivery.
And when you think of British single-payer system, what's the first thing that comes to your mind?
Well, first, the British public love it because it is perceived as being free at the point of service. Certainly, we all know nothing is for free.
Right.
And so it's paid for through taxpayer revenues. It's certainly available to all at the point of service. However, the costs are obviously much less, $3,000 per capita in Britain compared to over three times that in the U.S. But when you look at the results of a delivery system, which is basically socialized, single-payer, inexpensive, the results, for instance, deaths from breast cancer, colon cancer, heart attack, are much higher over there than compared to the United States with a quasi-private, public-private system.
Well, free sounds great, but nothing is ever free, as we've just pointed out. But at the same time, everybody can have access to it. But when it comes to someone suffering and dying in the family, it's a whole different perspective.
Indeed. So certainly people have access to it. But then that's when the complexities arrive, because the waiting list to see a physician is very high, and that is a hotly contended topic in the British newspapers. When you do get to see a surgeon or a specialist, the waiting list for surgery is months or even longer. And the waiting list that's published in the British press currently for people waiting to see a physician or have surgery is about 3.4 million people. So access is there for sure, but delivery on that quote-unquote free system is not as good as it sometimes is envisioned over here in the U.S.
Well, in one of your chapters, you talk about this waiting list, and you well, tell us about when you first discovered the waiting list. What it was a mind-altering experience.
It really was, and people were being put on this waiting list for years and years and years, classified by the kind of surgery that they needed and the urgency. Clearly, the cancers came first and were operated on as a priority. But the things like the gallbladders and the varicose veins and the hernias, they were simply put on a list and typically stayed there. And I remember as if it was yesterday, I pulled out these drawers with 2x3-inch index cards in them with names and addresses and phone numbers. And as I said in the book, I called these people, starting from the back, who had been on the list the longest, and nine times out of ten, these people were no longer with us. And that was a very sobering experience.
So the waiting list was more like a library, not just a list.
Indeed. The British accept this. It's a cultural difference, and it's certainly a difference in expectations. So I think the typical British mentality is, well, you know, everybody's in the same boat. Nobody's getting priority treatment. And it's quote-unquote free, which obviously, as we said, it is not. And so this has historically been tolerated and accepted in the British public for the most part. The private sector is available, but obviously the private sector costs money. And historically, only about 10% of the British public make use of the private system.
Well, your first chapter gets right to the point, and the point is dealing with the death panel. So,
right,
give us some overview on that.
So, expectations in Britain are far different than they are in the U.S. For a litany of reasons. So, if a loved one, for instance, is on death's door. There is less technology over in Britain to resuscitate them, to maintain them during a prolonged or even unsuccessful period of very, very, very ill health. And so the British public as a whole typically accept that we can't pour money, quote-unquote, down the drain. That's too harsh. But, you know, there has to be some expectation where care is withdrawn and the patient is just left to die. In the U.S., we have a greater expectations. And I have been there hundreds of times in the ICU when the patient is not doing well and it looks like things are not going to turn out. And you turn to the family and you have that most difficult conversation saying, what do you want us to do? And the expectations are different. The cost of healthcare, 90% of the healthcare costs are in the last few years of life, being sucked up by these high-tech, invasive, life-sustaining procedures where, you know, perhaps we should call in a relatively new specialty called end-of-life specialists, which come to the family and they say, look, we, you know, this is obviously a very sad time for you. We feel your grief. We're here with you, but we don't think this is really going to work, and we think we need to start weaning your loved one from all this major technology, healthcare sustaining efforts, sometimes to no avail, unfortunately. So the expectations are different. The availability of technology is a lot different. Obviously, we have much more invasive, life-sustaining technology in the U.S. than we do in the U.K., and it really sometimes is a kind of self-perpetuating system where the last years of life really absorb a disproportionate amount of healthcare funds.
It's great to have a healthcare card that gives some kind of, I guess, comfort, and, you know, to have to know that you're somehow insured. But at the same time, the society, the culture, as you pointed out, they've been so used to this for so long, it's just, well, that's the way it is when you live in Britain. But here, we expect something to happen right now. We go to the emergency room. We go, you know, everything is a right now kind of mentality.
Indeed. So ideal as it would be that everybody were to have health insurance and health coverage, I kind of view it as almost full employment. Clearly, we're at like 4.7% unemployment now, and I sometimes see parallels between the unemployment rate and the uninsured rate for the simple reason that the people without health insurance historically are young people who don't want to, you know, quote, waste their money on healthcare insurance because they're not going to need it because they're young and they're healthy and they're invulnerable. And these people don't feel like they should have to buy it, and obviously that was part of the pushback in the individual mandate under Obamacare. But when you look at the flip side in Britain, there are these 3.4 million people on the waiting list, and when you multiply that by six to account for the population differences, then we come to 20 million people, which is the number of individuals, quote-unquote, uninsured in the U.S. prior to Obamacare. So there probably is no such thing as universal coverage or free-for-all or, you know, access is certainly there nominally or notionally in the National Health Service in Britain. But in practice, if there are 3.4 million people on a list, that's not really doing them much good. And when you translate the numbers, 3.4 million Britons is the equivalent of 20 million Americans. So it's kind of it's ironic, it's strange how these numbers keep cropping up.
A lot of talk about replacing Obamacare. We're not sure where it's going, but even if it stays the same, what Obamacare has turned into is, even though everybody can get a card, but still, because of the cost, because of the deductible, huge deductibles, it's not what it was told us that it was going to be like. So here we are again, where we're always seem to be on the precipice of not a good return here.
Right. And it's ironic to see the kind of parallels that we see between Obamacare. Yes, notionally they have insurance. When it comes into practice, when it comes to implementing that insurance and getting health care, it's a similar pattern to Britain. Yes, they have coverage, but their names are put on a waiting list, as in 3.4 million people, and having to actually execute on this delivery of health care is sometimes the most challenging aspect of health care delivery. It's fine having a plan to deliver it, and it's fine having socialized medicine and universal health care, but you know, if your name is just put on a waiting list or you can't afford the co-pays or the deductibles, it's all pie in the sky. The good thing in the U.S. is there, as far as the uninsured are concerned, there always has been access to health care. So there are laws out there, such as the COBRA law, which says if any person uninsured arrives at your hospital with a, say, for instance, a surgical emergency, that patient will be treated in your hospital at your cost, the same as any other patient if they had insurance. So that is to prevent hospitals shipping patients, uninsured patients, out to secondary or tertiary hospitals to kind of pass the parcel. So even though these individuals are technically uninsured, they are still protected by laws such as COBRA, which mandates the hospital to treat them.
Your book is 53,000 words long, but you say you can summarize it in three words. Don't do it.
Don't do it.
Don't do right. it. Yes. Don't do so, it, America. Don't do it.
Having worked in both systems, what is clear is that, and one doesn't want to draw any parallels necessarily with big socialized organizations in the U.S., but I think we all understand when something comes under the government umbrella and it is managed by bureaucrats and technocrats and government departments, maybe these people are not as proactive as, for instance, in the private healthcare industry, which maybe are a little lighter and more versatile in getting the job done. So the problem that I saw in the National Health Service is this was a massive social program, which the cogs ground slowly, and sometimes they kind of fell off, and sometimes they ground to a halt, as opposed to in the U.S., where at least we still have a pretty diverse system of public, Medicare, Medicaid, of private, the Aetnas, the Humanas, all of the remaining private healthcare insurers. And I think it's important that we maintain that diversity as best we can and for as long as we can, so that those people that feel like they want to spend more money, that have the ability to spend more money, can do that as a right without being forced into it, and yet we maintain that social safety net of the Medicares and the Medicaids and all the current social healthcare delivery programs that we have.
Well, we appreciate your firsthand experience and insight, Dr. Armstrong, in your book titled Left Shift: How and Why America is Heading to a Second-Rate Single-Payer Healthcare. What's the best way to get your book, Dr. Armstrong?
Either Amazon.com, where everybody gets everything, or Archway. It's available online as a hardback, paperback, or audio version.
Thank you so much for joining us on Indie Book Publishing.
I appreciate your time, and you have a great day.
And this interview has been brought to everyone by Archway Publishing.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.